Okay, I think I would like to start with this very familiar question that actually was asked and answered more than 35 years ago. As far as I can understand, not much has changed from the point of view of theoretical understanding. I mean, yes, the answer still stands, which is this. Namely that electrons by themselves cannot reach equilibrium in an Anderson-localized system. The answer is less clear if the interaction is long range and in 3D. Now, from the experimental point of view, there's been a different answer, at least to this first part, about short range, not short range interaction, about the interaction effect in 2D. Several experimental groups suggested that the answer is actually yes, that electron-electron can mediate energy between localized states and do not need help from phonons or any other buff. This is not necessarily a contradiction with the theory, because the experiment is certainly not a short range, and probably not very weak interaction either. But the experiment that I'm going to show you today actually reached the opposite conclusion, which is closer to what the theory says in some respect. Can even answer something that the theory so far was not able to give an answer, but also I'll show you some puzzles that still exist in this issue. Now, the experimental platform that I'm going to use for this experiment is the electron glass. Electron glass is a natural consequence of interaction and disorder, like in any other glass. I'll give you a cartoon picture, and you know that disordered by itself, an interaction by itself, would like to configure the electronic space energy system in a quite a different way. So when you put them together, you get the frustration, which is the usual course of obtaining most glasses that we know of. And therefore, since in Anderson insulators, usually interaction and disorder coexist, and usually they are quite strong and more or less of the same order of magnitude, so it is very natural that an Anderson insulator is an electron glass. Now, by today, there are at least 7 different Anderson insulators that we can think of as showing this electron glass properties. And they show very interesting effects. I think one of the most exciting thing about electron glass, as opposed to most other glasses, it is a quantum glass. But that is not important for the subject that I'm going to raise today. In fact, the only thing which is important to me is to show you the basic feature of the electron glass, which is the way it approaches thermal equilibrium from an excited state. And that typically looks like this. The system that I'm going to show you for most of the talk are thin films of polycrystalline indium oxide. If it's something else, it will be mentioned specifically. It's a thin film. All the films that I'm going to show you are with 1 mega or more larger, so strongly localized. The temperature, unless otherwise specified, is always 4.1 degrees Kelvin. So this is an example of a quantum quench. You take the system at room temperature, and you stick it quickly into a cold bath. And after a few seconds of sizzling, everything quiets down. And what you see, if you measure the conductance, that it goes down, down, down. And it persists of going down like almost 6 decades, showing this very typical relaxation law, which is purely logarithmic in time. That's another thing which I think quite specific to electron glass. I mean, in spin glass, for instance, I've yet to see any spin glass that shows a simple relaxation law. But all the electron glasses, yes?
Can I ask a question? So, not sure about quantum glass. But classical glass, I should think of Efrat Shklovsky's pseudogap in the density of states. Is that the definition of classical glass?
I agree with you, and in fact...
I'm asking a question, I don't work in this.
So what is the question is, do you want
the
to
question know... question is, what's the definition of, to start with, what's the definition of a glass at zero temperature? The glass ground state is something where Coulomb interactions suppress the density of states, give you some kind of a... Is that right?
Now, for me, the definition of a glass is that you show glassy properties, and we can, you know, list them if you like. But for the purpose of this talk, I don't need to go into that. If you like, we can discuss that separately. When I mean quantum, by the way, okay, I mean that, for instance, the dynamics upon cooling does not slow down. Okay, but I'm not going to discuss that. But since you mentioned Efrat Shklovsky, the Coulomb gap, there is a Coulomb gap in this experiment, and again, I'm not going to discuss it or show it. There is. And it doesn't...
The Coulomb gap is the same over this time? Or
no, the Coulomb gap evolves the same way as you see here.
I see.
Oh, the signature of the Coulomb gap, actually. The signature of the Coulomb gap, it is not necessarily the Efrat Shklovsky. I don't think it is. But it shares many features with the Efrat Shklovsky. Okay? Like, for instance, it moves with the Fermi energy. Okay?
These are 3D
some,
I forget.
Oh, these are 2D, but I'll show you later 3D as well. Okay, so this is 2D, and this is the one thing that I'm going to use, that it has this property, namely that from an excited state, if you let it now reach equilibrium, this is the way it's going to do it, logarithmically in time. Okay?
But how do you measure an extension?
I measure conductance.
Okay.
That's what I measure, and I see that it's time dependent. As long as it is moving one way, like down in this case, I say it has not reached equilibrium. Once it stabilizes, except for some noise, I have no way of telling. Is it already fully equilibrated or just buried in the noise? So that's the limit of what I can do. So since this is electronic glass, there are many ways to take it out of equilibrium. And again, I'm going only to use one. And this one is the following. You see, the conductance of this strongly localized electronic systems is strongly dependent on the voltage that you use in when you measure the conductance. So this is the setup. It's very simple. Okay? You don't have to worry about the technology. I exempt you of that. So as you raise the voltage, in this case it's plotted as a function of the field, you see the conductance increases. In fact, it's very, very difficult to be in the ohmic regime. You can come close, but you're never really there. Okay, but nevertheless, I would call that a ohmic regime. Now, why does the conductance increases with voltage in this strongly localized regime? The reason it increases with voltage is there is an adiabatic mechanism. It's field-assisted Hopping. A lot of people talk about heating. Heating is what actually we're going to use, but heating is a small part of the increase of the conductance. A very small part. In fact, when the resistance goes very big, it's almost negligible. Okay? I'll show you I'll show you a demonstration that you can have change of the conductance without heating altogether, but not vice versa. In a DC, there's always going to be some heating, and this is what we're going to use. Now, the protocol that I'm going to use throughout the talk is what we call the stress protocol, which is plotted here. We start from as close to equilibrium as we can to establish a baseline. Then at some point in time, we increase the voltage to a high value. Immediately, the conductance jumps. Then, while we keep the conductance constant, okay, the conductance keep on increasing. That's another thing which the electron glass can show easily, whereas in other glasses, it's accepted but difficult to monitor in real time, which is called the time-dependent heat capacity. Actually, it takes time for the system to absorb energy. And then after a certain given time, we resume the measurement of the conductance as a function of time, but after we revert the voltage to the ohmic regime. And you can see that when we do that, the conductance has not reached the baseline. It is still now relaxing with time, and it's relaxing logarithmically as before. I'm going to show you that. Okay, this is what we call the stress protocol. It is the electronic analog of a mechanical experiment with a polymer, okay, that if you use a force, immediately it is stretched. And you keep now the force constant, the length of the polymer actually keeps increasing with time, also slowly. And when you let go, you see more or less the same result. So this is what we call a stress protocol. Now, you may ask, as I said, that now we actually pump energy into the system, and I claim by some heating, joule heating, you may ask, if the system is discrete, as a discrete spectrum, how do we impart arbitrarily small energy to it? Now, of course, at finite temperature, those states which I plotted as being discrete are actually a little bit widened there is a lifetime broadening, and this lifetime broadening gives width to these states. And the two main contributions that we know from condensed matter are either electron-electron or electron-phonon. And the whole idea of what I'm going to show you next is just to map and see the limit of this in order to get information of what is this rate of inelastic scattering and who is responsible for it. That's the whole idea. And now how are we going to do it? The idea is the following. We start with a system at equilibrium, as before, and we use the stress protocol, okay? And we take the magnitude of the excess conductance that we obtain after applying the stress for a given amount of time, we take it as a measure of how much energy the system absorbs from the electric field. And how do we do it? We plot this as a function of the log of the time, and we let the computer tell us what is the difference, and now we're going to use that using fields with different frequencies, starting from DC, then increasing the frequency, and repeat it again and again and again, many times, and see, at some point in frequency, we will see that the system does not absorb energy any longer, and that would be this width of this mini-band, which will give us an idea of what is the rate of inelastic scattering in the system. And in order to make a comparison meaningful, we have to make sure that in all frequencies that we are going to use in this stress protocol, the initial jump of the conductance here will be the same for all frequencies, and it will be kept. The stress will be kept on the sample for the same amount of time. And then we'll see what is the excess conductance after we torture the sample. Okay.
I mean, I see that the change in conductance tells you something useful about how the system's changed, but
how much energy?
Why does it tell you how much energy is produced?
Because it tells me by how much I heated the sample. But I'm not even about quantity. All I want to see is what frequency I stopped losing the ability to impart energy from the electric field to the sample. And I claim that this threshold, it tells me something about this lifetime broadening of the discrete state.
I'm also confused. Well, when you introduced this sort of nonlinear ID or GD,
yeah.
You mentioned that a lot of people want to think about the heating effect, but there's also this, what you call the field assisted popping.
Yes.
But that's not a heating effect.
It is not.
So how do you know that, wouldn't it be easier to just measure the temperature increase after this protocol?
It's very, the temperature of the electrons. We'll come to that.
I see. That's difficult.
We'll come to that. We need it.
So but how do you separate this field assisted hopping that you mentioned from heating?
I may not be able to give you in this talk the answer, but the way, again, we use one of the properties of the electron glass for that, okay? But let's come to that point, okay? We'll come to that point and then we'll discuss it again. So then we look. Let's look at the results. And by the way, let me make one point clear. I don't want people to get misled by that. The conductance is measured all the time by DC. Okay, but in the presence of an AC field to stress the sample. Okay. So now these are the results, and you can see that up to some frequency, the absorption from the field is more or less the same. Then it starts go down, it goes down gradually, and at a high frequency, there is no absorption any longer. Okay? Now, let me show you that in the raw data, so you will see that this is not something that just comes from the computer. This is the stress protocol, the stress, in two cases, using the 730 Hertz, and this is what I showed you all the time, which is here, as opposed to when we use 2.5 gigahertz, okay, which is here. And you can see that during the stress, there is only noise. And after that, there is no slow relaxation, maybe a small part. Look, this 2.5 gigahertz is chosen by with some thought in mind. This is exactly what you have in your microwave oven in the kitchen. So it's very difficult to completely eliminate heating because sample is not alone in the world. There is some other animals around it, and you have to make sure that all of them are fairly microwave safe.
Stupid question. So you measure the DC conductance in the presence of pumping at such AC.
Exactly.
Right.
So you see, not only that, you can raise the conductance of the sample without any heating whatsoever. You cannot do the opposite. Okay. So remember that.
So how do we know there's no heating?
Well, heating gives you this, that we know. We can put DC, we are absolutely guaranteed to have joule heating. Okay?
So,
I'm not saying how much heating. All I'm saying that the only thing I care about at what frequency we start losing being able to put energy from the electrical source, from the voltage source into the sample, which certainly must come through the electrons. So the electrons are not able to absorb energy from the field and do whatever they want with it. That's not possible. So now, what we would like to know, what is this roll-off frequency? Where, what does it mean? What is the physics of that? And now we'll come to your question about this heating and how much. First, let's do something very rough. We'll take this heat balance equation, joule heating on the left-hand side and the heat that leaves the system on the other side. We know basically almost everything except for this T star. Okay, we know everything. We know the sample dimension. We know its capacity of this material. We know all that. What we don't know, in order to calculate this rate, this gamma, how much heat goes away from the sample, we only want to know the T star. So let us assume that everything is heating. Okay? The reason we can do it, despite the fact that this is a small part of the increase of the conductance, if we do that, this is the result we get. What we do is the following. We use the sample as a thermometer. It's a mistake. I'll repeat it. It's a mistake to do it if it is important. Here it is not important. 20% of the increase of the conductance is due to heating, and we know it because we have a way of measuring the real temperature of the electrons in a way that I would happy to discuss with anybody that's interested. It has to do with another property of the electron glass. But it doesn't matter, because if I use this very approximate, very inaccurate procedure of using a sample as the resistance of a sample as a thermometer, let me repeat, it's a mistake. You're using a property that you measure the resistance as a function of temperature in the linear response to calibrate it as a thermometer, that's fine, it's okay. But to use the resistance out of equilibrium to conclude from that that this is the temperature is a mistake, okay? Fine. So when we do that, you see that this all actually falls in the right ballpark. The heat, the rate that heat is removed from the system happens to be at the right point. So how does heat leave the sample? Obviously, phonons. Therefore, we conclude that this role of frequency and the gamma inelastic, which we were after in the first place, is indeed due to electron phonon. Now, what is interesting is that this is the reason why we use this specific system in the first place, is that we compare that inelastic rate with the same system, but at the same temperature, but in the diffusive regime. And why? Because in the diffusive regime, we have some wonderful tools, weak localization, magnetoresistance, to measure both the electron-electron inelastic rate at this temperature in this system, and the electron phonon with some twist. Okay? And this is how it looks in this film when it is in the diffusive regime with this resistance at this temperature. This is the electron-electron, this is the electron phonon, okay? T to the power 4, this is linear in temperature, and this is only 3 kilo. That samples that we are talking about are much, much larger. You know, in the diffusive regime, the electron-electron inelastic rate increases with the resistance. So it could be, if it were in the diffusive regime and we push the resistance by 3 orders of magnitude or even more, we expect that this rate would be even larger. But even that is, as you'll see, is large enough, because now let's compare this at the temperature that we are after, namely 4 degrees, with what we get from the stress experiments. So let's start with the electron phonon. Okay, we take the value at 4 degrees. That sits not far from our estimate of the heat leaving the sample. So that seems to make sense, although there is no reason to expect that the electron phonon measured in the diffusive regime would be similar to what it is in the Hopping regime. Unfortunately, I looked very, very hard for that. There is no theory for electron phonon inelastic rate in the Hopping regime. Yes?
So these are just samples of different amounts of disorder?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Not much. Not much. It doesn't take very much to push it over the limit. You know, 3 kilo ohms is not far from the transition. Okay? Things are not linear with the disorder. They are linear up to a point. After that, they shoot up. So that seems to make sense. But let me also know.
What's the disorder here? I'm just,
the what is the reason for the disorder?
What kind of disorder is it?
Okay. That's a good question. Both in crystalline indium oxide and all amorphous indium oxide versions, and ITC materials, most of the disorder comes, is chemical origin of vacancies. There are vacancies, a lot of vacancies. That's why it is conducting in the first place. The basic material is ionic insulator with a large gap. Okay. So most of the disorder comes from there. It's very similar, by the way.
Wait, this is what, oxygen vacancies?
Oxygen vacancies, yes, absolutely, yeah. Right. So now let's compare the rate of the electron-electron inelastic rate, and this is here. And obviously, we are missing like 5-6 orders of magnitude. Okay. Now, so at some point along the disorder scale, we crank up the disorder. While we were in the diffusive regime, the electron-electron inelastic rate kept on increasing with disorder. At some point, it must have been reversed. So there are some people who say that if you lose 6 orders of magnitude, it might all the way go to zero. So there is no inelastic scattering from electron-electron. They cannot communicate between one another. They can communicate, however, through the phonons. Okay, and that is one of the consequences, one of the conclusions that I think we must reach from this study, that the reason for the hopping process, or the mechanism that mediate the hopping, is the electron phonon, with due respect to those experimentalists that use the prefactor as evidence. I don't agree with that. But on the other hand, there is no problem with thermalization, and everything is fine, as long as there are phonons. Okay, now, is 3B, is it different?
Can I just ask a question? So, you mentioned that you put AC signal through the contacts?
I do.
Okay, yes. So at 2.6 gigahertz, right, if I put an AC, I mean, the current paths must be extremely homogeneous.
It is extremely inhomogeneous in DC. Extremely inhomogeneous in DC.
I mean, the question is that, you know, I thought that, you know, whether you put it in a cavity where the electric field, imposed electric field. Basically, what I'm trying to ask is that if you attach leads at 2.6 gigahertz, the electric field that you impose.
No, you don't attach leads. It is capacitively coupled, but that's okay. Yeah.
Okay. No, but the DC one is attached leads.
Of course.
Okay, that's all I was asking. Okay.
Yeah, of course.
Because at some point I
Of course, you have to screen out the high frequency from the measurement, otherwise you are in bad shape.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Okay. So for this experiment in 3D, it was easier for us to do it with one of the amorphous indium oxide, a lot of different versions. And these are the results. Again, if we compare it with the electron-electron inelastic rate in the diffusive regime of this system, which you can also do, you can see that here that the difference is not that dramatic. And the result actually is because the electron phonon in elastic rate in the amorphous material is orders of magnitude larger than the crystalline material. So guys, if you want to use a system with very few phonons, you better stick with crystalline indium oxide, because the electron phonon there is very, very weak. In this case, the electron phonon is not weak at all. It's not surprising. It is even superconducting when the disorder is small enough. Okay. So so these are the results. And now there were some people that said, look, what are you surprised that electron-electron didn't do much to this single particle localization? After all, let's look at the discreteness of the system that you are working with, both systems. So what is a certain measure of the discreteness of the system? This is something that you get from the hopping law. That's, again, something that people use almost blindly. Me too, you know, when it is convenient for me. And from the temperature dependence, in principle, it allows you to say something about T0, which in fact is no other than, I think it's here, yeah? No, it's not here. But this is what you get from the T0, actually tells you something about the level spacing. Okay? And if you look at what is the possible Coulomb interaction over some scale, and I took for the scale the hopping length in this temperature, but it's not going to change much if I take something shorter. So this energy is about a few hundred Kelvin at most, which is much smaller than those systems that I was showing you, where the discreteness is much, at least an order of magnitude larger. Okay? So that seems to say that the electron-electron is weak. I don't agree with that. I don't think that this is the right comparison. And in particular, and this is the thing which I would like very much to show you, that actually there may be this electrostatic energy or interaction energy may be comparable, especially in 3B, may be comparable with the distance to the mobility edge, and maybe even much larger than that, in which case, should show some effect, I would think, about the proceedings, which we don't see. Now, Where is the mobility edge, if it exists?
Well, first of all, what you have here, this is actually the variable I'm dropping, right?
Yes.
This is what you see now from the data. If I would not tell you the dimension, what would be the error bar on the exponent?
If you want to know whether can we distinguish between 2 to the 1, t to the 1/3 to t to the 1/4, the answer is no. Since you asked, I would tell you that the fit by itself doesn't mean anything to me. What is more important is that the parameters that come out from the fit, if you can measure them independently, then I would believe it. Because it should not show t to the 1/3, it shouldn't show t to the 1/4, it shouldn't show t to the 1/2. It's all make-believe. Don't take it too seriously. As I said, I'm not too crazy about it in this way.
It's a factor of 2 on the x scale.
What? Where? Here?
No, in the top. In the top, 0.7.
Factor of 2? Here? Yeah. It's a lot, because it's t to the 1/4. You have to raise it to the fourth power. What is more important is the change of the conductance, but I don't disagree with you that it is not unique. Yeah.
So I thought that whenever you write C equals 35 angstroms, 40 angstroms, that's taking T0 as a level spacing and then estimating. How do you estimate? So you don't independently.
No, we know the density of state.
Right.
We know. Yeah, we do. Sure. The thermodynamic density.
Right.
Yeah. But sure.
Where do you know the density of states?
What?
How do we know the density of states?
How do we know? We measure the Hall effect at room temperature. Okay.
Okay.
So.
So there is no other. So it would have been comforting if you could measure localization length by other means and compare it.
We do. We have magneto resistance, for instance. There are a lot of other stuff. Actually, the field. See this mechanism that changes the non-ohmic mechanism. Also allows you to get some information about localization.
Yes.
But all those theories are very, very, very crude. But it all makes sense, There is nothing out of this world in these numbers. Now, what I want to show you...
Did you say that the interaction strength was at least comparable to this distance to the mobility edge?
That we don't know. So I'm asking, where is the mobility edge? Okay, so this is the thing that I'm going to show you next. There is something very puzzling about the behavior of the conductance versus temperature in 3D in particular. So this is the, for me, more important than all that stuff. Why? I'll tell you later.
Wait a minute, indium oxide, I'm trying to remember. Does it have strong spin-orbit coupling?
By itself, crystalline material, no. But if you put gold, a little bit gold into it, you immediately make...
In this data, there's no strong spin-orbit coupling.
No.
Okay.
In the amorphous material, no, even in the amorphous material, there is no. Okay, so I want to talk about a conductance versus temperature, and you'll see that this is where something about the mobility edge may come out. So this is, as you can see, data was taken almost 40 years ago, what? Really history. Data was taken by hand, were taken by hand. Okay, you see? And for a reason that I'm going to show you soon, I stopped the measurement here at this temperature. I stopped showing the results, actually. And if you look at this result, there are 4 samples. One of them, this one, appears to be insulating. It extrapolates naturally to 0 temperature. 0 value of the conductance at 0 temperature, even slightly before that. All the other 3 appears by natural extrapolation to be conducting. Right? Now, the actual measurement tells you something else. Let me show you that again. Look. Okay, so if you stop the measurement at, say, 50 or 70 degrees, you say, samples are metallic. You go down. No, sample is insulated. You change its mind. Okay. Now, here's another one. This one from Berkeley, taken exactly 20 years later, of course he doesn't know about this work. And the reason he doesn't know about this work is there is no theory to explain that. Okay?
Is that material magnetic, the manganese?
This one is not. This one is not. Let me put a name on it. I called it at the time the T-star problem, which can be summarized like that. Above a certain temperature, the sample, which is actually insulating, appears to be metallic. Here, a bunch of other materials that I've seen more recently, even granular aluminum, a phase change material, amorphous gadolinium, you're right, those are magnetic. This one is not, this one is superconducting, this one is neither. Just a useful material, which is, by the way, also an electron glass. Okay? So this is quite common. In fact, you have to show me one sample near the metal insulator transition in 3D, which can be measured at high temperature and does not show this problem. So, now I want to show you the last piece to reach the point. So this now is crystalline indium oxide. This is, I saved it for last. It's the best. It's the first one to show this effect. Okay. So this sample, for instance, which is labeled C, has been measured at lower temperature, and you can see the same funny shape. Now here comes the interesting part. This sample can be made also in the two-dimensional, as I told you before. Now it's a thin film, a bunch of curves as a function of temperature over the same temperature range and over the same bulk conductivity, same material, same disorder, so to speak. This one does not show this problem even in the diffusive regime, which is logarithmic, a logarithmic with this temperature. All these curves have a natural extrapolation to zero conductance at zero temperature, which is not the case in 3D. So that smells very, very bad from this is 3D, this is 2D. What's the difference between 3D and 2D? That is very pertinent to this problem. Mobility edge. So there is a certain energy above which, when you raise the temperature, you actually sample metallic state, dirty metal. So it would look metallic. Okay? Yeah, there is a problem with it. And this is the problem is the following. Which mobility edge is it? Now, let's try to remember what we learned in the 80s. About the position of the mobility edge. So the scaling said something about that, that there is the distance to the mobility edge would be something in the power of, I'll put a 1 because it's close to 1 anyhow, with a certain amplitude, E star. And I don't know what is your answer, but at the time I asked a lot of experts in the field, and they said, you know, in a non-interacting case, what can be this energy scale except for Fermi energy? So here's the problem. If that was the case, Fermi energy in this case is about 800K. If I look at this inflection point in the conductance data as indicative for the position of the mobility edge, it does follow that that form, which is expected, but with a prefactor that is much, much smaller than what you expect. It's much smaller than the Fermi energy. So this is, yeah.
This is only 3D, is that right?
3D, absolutely, all 3D. So here's a problem. No? We have to understand what is going on before, you know, we proceed with something more complicated. Can interaction lead to that? Is it possible that the mobility edge is much closer because, you know, of what Anderson was actually ruling out in his paper with Fleischmann, that you may have a virtual excursion to conducting states? which would change the whole ballgame. We don't know the answer for this. So let me quickly summarize.
But can you look? Can you do photoconductivity experiments?
I wish. All I need for that is ability to use a spectrometer at low temperature, which is a fine tuning from deep infrared. So I don't want to start complaining. I'll complain later. Okay.
So all
the synchrotrons in the world are now, and rightfully so, busy doing biology. Okay.
So a related question: for the 2D samples, can you change the density with a gate?
Yes, we can, but not very much. You see, the problem is all those systems have a very high concentration of electrons, so the gate is extremely ineffective. Mm-hmm. Recently, in this phase change material in germanium telluride, or actually the ones that doped with antimony, I recently found a way to change the carrier concentration appreciably by using persistent photoconductivity. That can be done. So if you have an idea about that, I would love to hear about it. What do you have in mind?
Well, I take your point that the explanation you're giving is really specific to 3D, because it's only in 3D that you have a mobility edge. But
not necessarily. You may have a mobility edge because the system, when you pump energy into it, either by temperature or by some other means, like photo excitation, you may be able to get many body effects, for instance. Which they may have a mobility edge even in 2D.
But I thought that even in 2D you could easily have the conductivity of states varying rather rapidly with energy, so that you could see a similar sort of effect with your E star and so on in 2D samples. And then if you could change the carrier density, you could move the Fermi energy up into the states
that contribute. Yeah, but why can't I do it just by manipulating the disorder? It's more convenient to do it with the gate. You can do it in situ, but I can change the disorder.
You are drilling 2D, but you're changing sequence. You manipulate disorder in this way.
I can do it independently. In a given thickness, I can, with the same sample, with the crystalline indium oxide, actually I do it by some sort of doping, because how do we manipulate in the crystalline material the disorder? Actually, we do something similar to what people do by doping. We just drive oxygen out or in. So we change a little bit the carrier concentration. And state of disorder, when you are in the insulating regime, a small change is enough to give you a big effect. Okay, so what we find, maybe I did not stress that point very much, that both electron-electron and electron-phonon are suppressed relative to the diffusive regime in the system. Okay, electron-electron may go all the way to zero by itself. Of course, there is the rate of effective rate of exchange of energy becomes the electron phonon, because they are always there at any temperature. So this is the first thing. And therefore, if there were no phonons, maybe the conductance would drop to zero. I have no problem with that. You know, by themselves, they cannot communicate apparently, and at least this part is something that you may feel good about. And the thing which experiment is doing, with the limitation of experiment, is namely that we don't know for sure that electron-electron went all the way to zero, but it went down by six orders of magnitude, which is quite a lot. And the thing is that this was tested for realistic range of interaction, not short range. It's not an infinite range, because at final temperature there is a hopping length above which there is screening. Okay, but it is quite a long range. And this problem in 3D, which I think really deserves an explanation. All those things that I showed you were already mentioned or hinted in the paper by Fleischmann and Anderson. And it is, I think, it tells something about us, the community, that those questions are still questions and not even begin to be answered. And that's all I wanted to tell you. Thank you.
So what can you learn from field-assisted hopping? Can you learn some other estimate for this T star? Consistent?
It is consistent. It is fairly consistent, I should say, except for one thing. Actually, the better way to measure independently localization length is magnetoresistance. And that's because, I don't know if you know, there are various theories for that. There is Benigun, Spivak, and Shklovsky, okay, which actually says that as opposed, the mechanism is actually similar. It's quantum interference in the same in this respect. And the cutoff for this quantum effect, instead of being the inelastic diffusion length, which is the cutoff length in the diffusive regime, here it is the hopping length. Therefore, if you do like anisotropy experiment and changing the thickness, you can easily see whether it is indeed this, and that has been seen. So we feel quite comfortable that within a factor of two, we know the right parameters. Okay. Now you may ask a different question. I mean, I showed you t to the one third. I showed you t to the one quarter. Where is the t to the one half? I don't think it follows from the Foshlovsky equation. Okay? Sorry. Yeah.
Magnetic susceptibility, does that show anything interesting as a function of temperature?
It is, I tell you, there was with another system that I mentioned, the germanium antimony telluride, where we suspect there is magnetic ordering for magnetoresistance measurement. So that it would be very interesting to do this experiment.
But not in the indium oxide.
I don't, well, you tell me why.
Well, just if the interactions are important, then that might lead you to, you know, singly occupied localized states, and you might be able to see
that. You're right. Because it's certainly the role of the spin by itself should be quite interesting. So the only thing in this regard we have is, again, from the magnetoresistance, is at high field where we can actually polarize the spins. And we don't see about, you know, I haven't shown this result about the signature of the underlying Coulomb gap. It does not change with magnetic field up to 33 Tesla. Other things do change, but that remains the same. So, yeah.
Just follow up on Mike's question. So, in a metal, not too thick of a metal, if you look at AC magnetic susceptibility, chi double, the second, the measuring part, any current heating basically guarantees for you that you can take the linear and omega signal, and the coefficient of that is conductivity. And this is the most linear response, the most homogeneous. Is this something that you would...
I think that...
Contactless. No contact.
No, I understand. I think that it's worth doing.
This is a really dumb question. So in the 3D films at low temperatures, you are supposed to add conductivities is that right? So if your chemical potential, the reason I'm asking is that the chemical potential is below the mobility edge. At very low temperatures, there's a channel of variable range hopping that will give you these non-trivial power loads.
Yes.
But the activating above the mobility, it should give you a separate additive contribution, which has a simple 1 over T.
Wait.
Is that not right?
No. At a higher temperature, what
does... No. I want to go to very low temperatures
and
ask how good is it fit to variable range hopping type thing? Or is it a simple activation?
No, it is not simple activation. It is variable range. And at a higher temperature, what is this?
No, higher temperatures... What I'm asking is that if you take your... hypothesis seriously, is it not true that you have two contributions, one of them is
absolutely
1/T and the other one is the variable range hopping, and you should be able to rule out your...
You mean the high temperature conductivity mechanism should exist at low temperature? That's what you're saying?
No, when you're at low temperatures, there's a small, there's exponential activity probability.
I see.
And get
we estimated that it's very small. It's very small. It's not going to change much. It dies out like in a very,
but it's
very
low temperature.
It's simple activation. Yeah.
Oh, because the power law is quarter.
Yeah. Very, very small. We actually estimated it. You're right. We thought about it. So I'm saying it is consistent with that, but we never said that. Actually, we never believed it, and I don't believe it even now.
Okay.
All I'm saying is that it deserves an explanation, because it is not just in crystalline indium oxide or in amorphous indium oxide. It is in everything. How can you ignore that? You see, the thing is that if you don't, I'm sorry to say that, we live in a time that if there is, you know, many, many years ago, maybe I did not live even then, there was, I think, a person that I worked with and I admired said, it ain't so until it has been measured. Now the statement must be, it ain't so until there is a theoretical model for it. And I find it, abnormal. Yeah, I know that you belong to a different.
Several things. So, first of all, when you use an AC field to stress the sample,
yeah.
When the frequency is above this cutoff frequency, do you have a picture for why the AC field affects the DC conductivity?
Yeah. As long as you see, what is the actual mechanism that is involved in reducing the conductance adiabatically and the resistance adiabatically? Hopping, you know, you have to take a tunneling event from a certain site to another one, which some of them are also different in different energy. So you have to make up for this difference in energy if you want to make that. So instead of the temperature fluctuating, giving you that, you may get it from the electric field, okay? So that's the whole idea. As long as you can move that, it will work. That's all. As long as those states can respond to the field, of course, there's going to be a certain field above which this is going to die out. But this must be a very high field.
And another question. So you started with the time dependence of the conductance when you quench from high temperature, and you have this logarithmic dependence going out for long times. Mm-hmm. So if you don't quench to 4 Kelvin, if you quench to a higher temperature, 10 Kelvin or something, is it known when you can see
There is no glass temperature. The glass temperature is like the Anderson, it's a zero temperature. What you see is a finite temperature effect. It leaves at zero temperature, you cannot measure anything.
Okay. So in any quench, you never
any quench, provided that at this temperature, okay, the sample already has resistance large enough, because if you are the diffusive regime, nothing, it's dead. Mm-hmm. Plus another thing, that cooling has to be quick. Otherwise, you pick up history from along the way. That's one of the pitfalls of this experiment with glasses. They remember everything that happened to them in the past, and they keep telling you about it until you are red in the face, you know.
So
if you make a mistake, you have to start all over again, and this is time.
So if you quench to the T star temperature, do you see anything different?
Okay, in 3D, all those experiments take time. This experiment is yet to be done. 3D, we have only one experiment over the last 20 years, only one set of experiments, 3D about glass. This conductance, that time we never thought about non-equilibrium and stuff like that. We believe that everything is instantaneous and so on. It's not.
Yeah. So another thing. So this is actually something that Roger Gratzoff suggested to me. I heard it from him a few years ago, in connection perhaps with T star. It's reasonably natural for the mobility edge to be pinned close to the thermoenergy, because if you have something like a Coulomb gap from interaction,
It will move with the chemical potential.
So maybe that could.
And unfortunately, that gate, a gate for 3D, is not so. It's a little bit complicated, because you are only affecting, you know, something close to the surface.
Yeah, I mean, you can't alloy the center. You can't alloy the. You can't change the carrier density by alloying.
In amorphous indium oxide, that's the beauty of that system. I mean, it has a lot of disadvantages, but this is the one big advantage, two actually, but this one in particular, that you can change carrier concentration in this system by four orders of magnitude by changing the ratio between indium and oxygen. In the crystalline material, there is a chemical constraint that prevents you from doing that. Okay, so you have other means. So, plus you have the added advantage that this is the only system where you can really change the disorder over a huge amount without changing carrier concentration.
No, so this question of moving the...
Moving the chemical potential.
Yeah, moving the chemical potential.
Yeah, but it's a different sample. So, what is that okay if I use different samples? Same material, but different doping, so to speak. Would that... I have to change the disorder.
At what temperature did the oxygen vacancies become mobile? Is that known?
Well, I know that they are fairly mobile at low temperature, and I know that they are fairly mobile at room temperature. They are. Yeah, very much. I mean, there is a strong diffusion of oxygen, enormous, because of a lot of space. So, you know, you can, at room temperature, you can play very nice games. I mean, change the concentration at one point, and after a while, you see that in a remote point. It's amazing. Yeah. But at low temperature, there is nothing.
At low, what's low?
So, at 4 degrees. I cannot tell you much of in between, you know. Those experiments, 4 degrees is very convenient.
Well, let's say in 3D relative to this crossover.
I don't know. Since it's probably exponential with temperature, it's probably safe to say that it's not going to change that very much. I don't think I can do that there. But, you know.
Is it okay for
yeah.
I wasn't satisfied with your answer to John's question about the logarithm. So if you have currently a protocol, you start with room temperature, you're dumping into...
Yeah.
4.1, you get beautiful data.
Yeah.
Suppose we keep the 4.1 but change the initial temperature from room temperature to 20 degrees above room temperature. Is the coefficient of the logarithm different? Is that...
Wait.
Or suppose we go to 8 Kelvin. I don't want to go to low temperatures.
Okay. No, no. What we did is something else. I mean, we quenched from 4 degrees to 1.6, for instance. Something like that. Yeah, okay, we can. That can happen.
I'm just saying that this logarithm, I think it's an actual question. You have such a beautiful logarithm over several decades.
Yes.
Does the I mean, if you wanted somebody to work on a theory, right, you want to give them something to explain, like, for example, the coefficient of the logarithm, how does it depend?
Well, it depends on the disorder as well.
No, but if you start with the same trivial, you know, 300 room temperature state that...
Yes.
All agree on what that does, suppose.
Okay.
Right. Yep. If you go to 4 Kelvin versus 8 Kelvin, if the no, maybe that the experiment actually is indistinguishable.
It would both. I guess.
But if it's still, you say that there is no temperature at which the logarithm disappears, right? So that presumably means the coefficient of the logarithm is different.
I'm not aware of that. What will happen is the magnitude of the effect will become smaller.
The coefficient of logarithm being smaller.
It will be smaller, of course.
Yes.
It will be smaller because...
Why?
What do you mean why? Because the resist... Well, as I said...
I don't know what the theory is.
Oh, okay. So I'm telling you that looks natural because all these effects are getting relatively larger. The bigger is the disorder or bigger the resistance. If you take the same sample and do the same experiment at a lower temperature, effect is bigger.
The resistance is
bigger. Bigger, yeah. Relatively bigger. Conductance, of course, becomes smaller.
So
the effect is bigger.
Is there a formula for the coefficient of logarithm as a function of resistance?
We didn't. If you give me a reason, I will do it. Yeah, we'll do it. I think, look, I think that the point to start is from what I did not show, and maybe if you want, I'll give you a full description independently from this, what we call memory dip, or those things that are really indicative of a glass, okay, and they show something that looks like sort of a Froschlowski-Coulomb gap. And there is a full systematics that goes along with that, like for instance, that this anomaly is a certainly systematic function of the carrier concentration of the system. Absolutely. And it doesn't change with anything else, which tells you that that must be electronic, nothing else. It cannot be anything else. Yes?
So is there any issue with homogeneity of the sample? I mean, so how well do you know that you actually extracted the heat from the whole sample, that all the pieces of it are sitting at the same temperature after the quench? I guess that's one question, and related one. So you apply the microwaves. So the microwaves presumably go through the sample, so there is no skin depth. So you can be confident that the effect throughout the sample.
Sample is a thin layer. Show that what we do actually with the microwave, we use an antenna to feed the microwave inside. And it's a cavity, as you can understand, because it's in a cryostat. What we usually do is we scan now the frequency of the microwave. We scan it and find out all those wiggles. Those wiggles are characteristic of this cavity that you work with. The sample is just a detector. I don't know, maybe since the wavelengths of something like 2 gigahertz is 10 centimeters, sample is a millimeter, I assume that everything is homogeneous in this respect. Temperature at the helium bath, you know, over a 1 millimeter, I don't think it changes very much.
Because, I mean, heating is probably fairly easy, right, to do.
Oh, the heating is a different story. The heating with, say, with DC, so I connect DC to the sample. It is absolutely inhomogeneous. Absolutely, because the carrying network is only a very small part of the sample, anyhow. Okay? Even under the best condition. In a semiconductor, it's not even there. It's much worse, usually. It's extremely inhomogeneous, much more than what you expect. But theoretically, if it follows, you know, the picture of your neighbor and others, there is a current carrying network, and it's fairly, dilute system. Only a very small part of the system actually participate in that.
So do you actually see evidence for that?
There is evidence for that. We have evidence for that.
So with cooling, it's typically very hard, right? I mean, because to extract heating, you have to go through the surface.
No, so the heating is inhomogeneous, but sure. The heat spreads,
Yeah. But so for the cooling, how rapid? So for you, does it matter that you're...
It doesn't matter. All I care about is to see a point where, despite the fact that I'm still able to increase the conductance of the sample, I don't get heating. I don't get something that I did get at lower frequency. Sample appears to be neutral in this respect. So now I ask why. And this is the interpretation. And it seems to be consistent. That's all I can tell. Okay.
There's been a lot of good discussions. So.
Yeah.